all at once. Lewis had a camp set up just below the forks. He had a canopy formed from one of the large sails. At 4 o'clock p.m., he called a conference. Dispensing with Driar and the sign language, he decided to use a translation chain that ran from Sacagawea, speaking Shoshone to the Indians and translating it into Hidatsa, to Charbonneau, who translated her Hidatsa into French, to Private Francis Labiche, who translated from French to English. Scarcely had they begun the cumbersome process when Sacagawea began to stare at Kamayawait. Suddenly recognizing him as her brother, she jumped up, ran and embraced him, and threw her blanket over him and cried profusely. What a piece of luck that was! No novelist would dare invent such a scene. As James Rhonda writes, the stars had danced for Lewis and Clark. Lewis wrote that the reunion was really affecting. He wrote not a word to indicate that he was surprised by the show of so much emotion from Sacagawea, whom he had characterized a couple of weeks earlier as someone who never showed the slightest emotion. When Sacagawea recovered herself, the council began, although it was frequently interrupted by her tears. The captains expanded on what Lewis had already told Kamayawait. They explained, "The objects which had brought us into this distant part of the country," in the process making it appear that the number one object was to help the Shoshones by finding a more direct way to bring arms to them. In the process, "we made them sensible of their dependence on the will of our government for every species of merchandise, as well for their defense and comfort." But this could not be accomplished without Shoshone horses, or without a guide to take them over the Nez Perce Trail. In reply, Kamayawait declared his wish to serve us in every respect, that he was sorry to find that it must yet be some time before they could be furnished with firearms, but said they could live as they had done heretofore until we brought them as we had promised. Though he had insufficient horses to carry the baggage over Lemhi Pass, he would return to his village in the morning and encourage his band to come and help. The captains were satisfied. Indeed, they could hardly have dared hope for so much cooperation. They asked Kamayawait to indicate who were the lesser chiefs among his men. He pointed to two others. The captains gave Kamayawait a medal with Jefferson's likeness on one side and the clasped hands of an Indian and a white man on the other, and gave a smaller medal with George Washington's likeness to the two inferior chiefs. Next, they presented Kamayawait with a uniform coat, a pair of scarlet leggings, a carrot of tobacco, and some gewgaws. The lesser chiefs got a shirt, leggings, a handkerchief, a knife, and some tobacco. The captains distributed paint, awls, knives, beads, mirrors, and other items to the remaining Indians. "Every article about us appeared to excite astonishment in their minds," Lewis wrote. "The appearance of the men, their arms, the canoes, York, the sagacity of my dog, all were objects of admiration." Lewis shot his air gun, which the Indians immediately pronounced great medicine. Adding to the joyous mood, the hunters brought in 4 deer and a pronghorn. After the feast, the captains asked Kamayawait for more information with respect to the country. He repeated what he had already told Lewis, who by now was convinced of the truth of his description. Even though he regarded Kamayawait as a man of influence, sense, and easy and reserved manners, appears to possess a great deal of sincerity, Clark wanted to see for himself before accepting Kamayawait's alarming description of the Salmon River route. He and Lewis conferred. Lewis agreed that in the morning Clark should set out with 11 men carrying axes and other necessary tools for making canoes. They would make a reconnaissance of the Salmon, accompanied by Charbonneau and Sacagawea. They would stay the first night at the Shoshone village to hasten the return of the band to Camp Fortunate to make the portage. If Clark found the river navigable, he would set to making canoes. Lewis, meanwhile, would bring on the remaining 18 members of the party and the baggage to the Lemhi River. He figured the move would take a week or more, enough time for Clark to make his reconnaissance and determine whether the expedition was to proceed by land or water. If by land, "we should want all the horses which we could purchase." Whatever the route, Lewis had cause for satisfaction. The expedition was once more united and would soon be on the move. He slept better than the previous night. In the morning, August 18th, While Clark prepared for his reconnaissance, Lewis traded for some horses. He intended to provide Clark with two to transport his baggage and keep one for his hunters to transport whatever meat they obtained. He got what he wanted. Three very good horses in exchange for a uniform coat, a pair of leggings, a few handkerchiefs, three knives, and some trinkets, the whole of which did not cost more than about $20 in the United States, not counting in the transportation costs. The Indian seemed quite as well pleased with their bargain as I was. One of the privates also purchased a horse for an old checked shirt, a pair of old leggings, and a knife. At such prices, Lewis could count on obtaining quite a herd from the main village on the Limhi River. A problem emerged. The two lesser chiefs were a little displeased at not getting more presents. Clark thereupon gave them a couple of his old coats, and Lewis promised that if they were active in assisting me over the mountains, I would give them an additional present. With that, at 10 o'clock a.m., Clark set off, accompanied by all the Indians save the two lesser chiefs, Jumping Fish, and another woman. Lewis prepared for the portage. He had all stores and baggage opened and aired, and had the men begin the process of forming packages into proper parcels for transport over Limhi Pass. He had rawhides put in the water in order to cut them into thongs proper for lashing the packages, a business which I fortunately had not to learn on this occasion. Driar brought in a deer. One of the men caught a beaver. Lewis had a net arranged and set to catch some trout. He brought his journal up to date. He concluded his August 18th journal entry with an oft-quoted passage of introspection and self-criticism. "This day I completed my 31st year," he began. He figured he was halfway through his life's journey. "I reflected that I had as yet done but little, very little indeed, to further the happiness of the human race, or to advance the information of the succeeding generation. I viewed with regret the many hours I have spent in indolence, and now sorely feel the want of that information which those hours would have given me had they been judiciously expended." He shook the mood, writing that, since the past could not be recalled, "I dash from me the gloomy thought and resolved in future to redouble my exertions and at least endeavor to promote those two primary objects of human existence by giving them the aid of that portion of talents which nature and fortune have bestowed on me." And here he seems to have lost his train of thought. Whatever the cause, he forgot to name those two primary objects of human existence, and instead ended, "In future, to live for mankind, as I have heretofore lived for myself." Much has been made of this remarkable passage, perhaps too much. It was not unusual for men of the Enlightenment to write such stuff. Come to that, a 30th or 31st birthday leads to such thoughts for men of the late 20th century, and Jefferson sometimes wrote in a similar mood and vein. Among other things, the passage is a reminder of how young Lewis was to be carrying so heavy a burden of command. Physically tired and emotionally exhausted after the tension of the past few days, he was in what is still today one of the most remote places on the continent, with only 18 enlisted men, Driar, and 4 Indians as companions. He had reached the source of the Missouri River, but he still had those tremendous mountains to cross and was dependent on the whims of Kamiyawade and his people to make that crossing. If he was halfway through his life's journey, always a gloomy thought for a young man, he was also only halfway through his journey of exploration from the Mandan village to the Pacific coast, and the season was getting on. To him, it seemed natural at this point to rededicate himself to doing better. Lewis spent 6 days at Camp Fortunate. It gave him an opportunity to write some extended descriptions of the Shoshones. In addition, he oversaw the breaking up of boxes and the cutting off of the paddle blades to make enough boards for 20 wooden saddles. He established another cache to lighten the burden of the portage. He made some celestial observations. On August 22nd, an hour before noon, Kamiyawate, Charbonneau, Sacajawea, and some 50 Shoshone men, accompanied by women and children, arrived at Camp Fortunate. After they set up camp, Lewis held a council. He distributed presents, especially to the second and third chiefs. Noting these poor devils half-starved, Lewis had the men prepare a meal of corn and beans, which he served after the council. Kamiawait said, he wished that his nation could live in a country where they could provide such food. Lewis gave him a few dried squashes. He had them boiled and declared them to be the best thing he had ever tasted except sugar, a small lump of which it seems his sister Sacagawea had given him. The trout net yielded 528 fish, most of which Lewis distributed among the Indians. He purchased 5 good horses for $6 in trade goods each. Though he wanted to get going first thing in the morning, Kamiawait requested that he wait another day so that a friendly band of Shoshones could join them. Lewis realized that he had no choice, but it brought on a new worry. The Shoshones were gathering for their annual excursion onto the Buffalo Plains, and Kamiawait's band showed a good deal of anxiety to get going. When the other group came in during the afternoon, Lewis managed to trade with them for 3 horses and a mule. On the morning of August 24th, Lewis was once again on the road, this time with 18 of his own men, Charbonneau, Sacagawea, and Driard, 9 horses and a mule, and Kamiawait's band. He gave Charbonneau some articles to trade for a horse for Sacagawea, which was done. He was going to need still more horses. Much of the baggage was being carried by Shoshone women. But notwithstanding future problems, he was happy because I had now the inexpressible satisfaction to find myself once more underway with all my baggage and party. His joy didn't last long. On August 25th, when the hunters brought in 3 deer and the party stopped for a noon meal, Charbonneau casually mentioned to Lewis that he expected to meet the whole of Kamiawait's band coming over Lemhi Pass on the way to the buffalo country. Why? Lewis asked. Charbonneau explained that Sacagawea had overheard Kamiawait say to some of his young men to tell the band to meet him the next day, so that together the reunited band could go to the Missouri River. If that happened, Lewis and his men would be left literally high and dry, halfway up Lemhi Pass, with only a dozen or so horses and no guide for the Nez Perce Trail. Another gut-tightening crisis. Lewis's temper flared, but he was too good a diplomat to direct it at the cause, Kamiawait. Instead, he cussed Charbonneau, who had been in possession of the information for some hours before divulging it to Lewis. Then he called Kamiawait and the 2 lesser chiefs for a smoke and a talk. I asked them if they had not promised to assist me with my baggage to their camp. They acknowledged that they had. Then why were they preparing to abandon him to go to the buffalo country? The Indians hung their heads. Lewis said that, had they not promised to help with the portage, I should not have attempted to pass the mountains, but would have returned down the river, and that in that case they would never have seen any more white men in their country. In truth, he was going to try to get over those mountains come hell or high water, a resolution he frequently put into his journal. Still, he took the high moral ground, instructing the chiefs that they must never promise us anything which they did not mean to perform. He concluded by directing the chiefs to send a young man over the pass to the village to tell the people to stay where they were until Lewis, Kamiawait, and the others arrived. The 2 lesser chiefs spoke up. They wanted to help and be as good as their word, they said, and it was not they who had instructed the band to cross to the Missouri River side of the divide. Kamiawait had done it, and they had not approved. This was a handsome payoff for Lewis's seeing their unhappiness a couple of days earlier and distributing more presents to them. Kamiawait remained silent for some time, Lewis wrote. At length he told me that he knew he had done wrong, but that he had been induced to that measure from seeing all his people hungry. But as he had promised to give me his assistance, he would not in future be worse than his word. His people were starving. The buffalo country was not much more than a day's march away. Other bands of Shoshones were already meeting with Flathead villages to go on the hunt. But he had given his word, and Lewis shamed him into keeping it. A pity that Lewis never showed the slightest gratitude or gave any indication that he understood what a difficult position Kamiawait was in. He did realize that the Shoshones had to eat. In the afternoon, the party marched almost to the pass. The hunters brought in but 1 deer. Lewis ordered it distributed to the women and children, and for my own part remained supperless. At dawn on August 26, the temperature was at the freezing point, a sharp reminder where none was needed that the season was getting along. During the day's march, Lewis saw the women collecting roots and feeding their poor, starved children. It is really distressing to witness the situation of those poor wretches. That evening, Lewis and his men and baggage made it to the camp on the Limhi River. Private John Coulter was already there, with a letter from Clark, who was in camp downstream, in which Clark described the Salmon River route as impassable. Lewis was not surprised. He told Kamiyawate that in the morning he wished to purchase 20 additional horses. Kamiyawate pointed out that his people had lost a great number of their horses to the Blackfeet, but said he would see what he could do. He also said he thought the old man who had once crossed the mountains with the Nez Perce would be willing to guide Lewis and Clark. Matters being thus far arranged, Lewis ended his journal entry for the day, I directed the fiddle to be played, and the party danced very merrily, much to the amusement and gratification of the natives, though I must confess that the state of my own mind at this moment did not well accord with the prevailing mirth, as I somewhat feared that the caprice of the Indians might suddenly induce them to withhold their horses from us, without which my hopes of prosecuting my voyage to advantage was lost. The Indians were ready to sell, but the captains discovered over the next few days that the price had gone up considerably. The Shoshones had a captive, desperate market. It was perfectly clear to them that the white men had to have horses, come what may. On August 29th, Clark found that he had to offer his pistol, a knife, and 100 rounds of ammunition for one horse. The captains had tried to make it a strict rule never to reduce their arsenal, but now they had no choice. Eventually, the captains bought 29 horses, but as James Ronda puts it, the Shoshones had proven to be better Yankee traders than the Americans. When Clark examined the horses in his corral, he found them to be nearly all sore backs and several poor and young. The captains had bought the cast-offs of the Shoshone herd. Chapter 23. Over the Bitter Roots, September 1st to October 6th, 1805. The party set out early on September 1st, traveling cross-country over high, rugged hills to today's North Fork of the Salmon River, Fish Creek to Lewis and Clark, following the Shoshone guide, whom the captains called Old Toby. They were headed almost due north and climbing toward the Continental Divide, on their right to the east, in rough, seldom-traveled mountainous country, with no Indian trail or any other sign of human presence. They were entering mountains far more difficult to pass than any American had ever attempted. The country is so remote and rugged that nearly two full centuries later it remains basically uninhabited. The confusion of creeks and ravines cutting through the steep mountainsides has made the route the expedition used one of the most disputed of the entire journey. One expert, Harry Majors, calls the route the single most obscure and enigmatic of the entire Lewis and Clark expedition. Clark described the route. Through thickets in which we were obliged to cut a road, over rocky hillsides where our horses were in perpetual danger of slipping to their certain destruction, and up and down steep hills with the greatest difficulty, risk, etc., we made 7.5 miles. As the party ascended toward the divide, the going grew worse. On September 3rd, it snowed. The last thermometer broke. Clark summed up the misery of the day. We passed over immense hills and some of the worst road that ever horses passed. Our horses frequently fell. There was no game in the mountains, save grouse. The expedition consumed the last of its salt pork. At least they got to the divide, whether at Lost Trail Pass or Chief Joseph Pass is disputed, which they followed for some miles along the present Idaho-Montana border before beginning their descent to the Bitterroot Valley west of the divide. There was a hard freeze that night. On September 4th, the party fell down a very steep descent to a north-flowing river that Lewis named Clark's River, today's Bitterroot River. There, at today's Ross's Hole, the captains encountered a band of the Salish Indians, some 400 people strong, with at least 500 horses. The Salish, whom the captains called Flatheads, a generic term with them, loosely used to signify all Northwest Indians, even though they did not deform their heads as Indians on the Columbia did, were friendly. The presence of Old Toby undoubtedly helped ease the way for the Americans, for the Salish were allies of the Shoshones. Indeed, this band was on its way to join Kamiawait's people at the Three Forks. Communication was possible if cumbersome. A Shoshone boy lived with the Flatheads. He could speak with the captains through the usual translation channels. As he habitually did with previously unknown Indians, Lewis made a vocabulary of the Salish language, taking special care in this instance because the Indians' throaty, guttural speech led him to conjecture that they were descendants of Prince Madoc and the Welsh Indians. Like many others, Jefferson believed that this persistent myth might well be true and had instructed Lewis to look for the tribe. The Salish were not Welsh, but they were, in Private Joseph Whitehouse's words, "the likeliest and honestest savages we have ever yet seen." They were also generous. Although their stock of provisions was as low as that of the expedition, they shared their berries and roots. And they traded for horses at much better prices than the Shoshones demanded, perhaps not aware of how desperate Lewis and Clark were. The captains bought 13 horses for a few articles of merchandise, and the Salish were kind enough to exchange 7 of the rundown Shoshone ponies for what Clark called elegant horses. The expedition now had approximately 39 horses, 3 colts, and 1 mule, for packing, riding, or food in the last extreme. On the morning of September 6th, the captains directed the men to lighten the loads on the Shoshone horses and pack the excess on the Salish horses. By mid-afternoon, that task was completed, and the party set off down the Bitterroot River north, while the Salish galloped out for Three Forks and the buffalo hunt. The expedition made 10 miles and camped, with nothing to eat but 2 grouse and some berries. The captains were out of flour and had in the larder only a little corn and the portable soup Lewis had purchased in Philadelphia. For the next 3 days, the descent of the wide and beautiful Bitterroot Valley was relatively easy. The expedition made 22 miles on the 7th, 23 on the 8th, and 21 on the 9th. But as they marched, the captains and their men kept looking to their left, west, at the snow-covered Bitterroot Mountains, described by Sergeant Patrick Gass as "the most terrible mountains I ever beheld." The barrier would have to be crossed. How, they could hardly imagine. The Bitterroot was wide enough to be floated in canoes, but the captains never thought of stopping to make the craft and becoming waterborne again. When they asked Old Toby about its course, he could only inform them that it continued to flow north as far as he knew it, and he did not know whether it joined the Columbia River or not. It did, but far to the north. In any case, the absence of salmon on the river told the captains that there had to be a great falls downstream. Making further geographical inquiries of Old Toby, Lewis learned that a few miles downstream, just west of today's Missoula, Montana, the Bitterroot was joined by another river, today's Clark Fork, that flowed from the Continental Divide through an extensive valley. If a party went up the Clark Fork to its source, it could cross the divide over a low pass and would then descend down a gentle road to the Missouri River near the gates of the Rocky Mountains. According to Old Toby, "a man might pass to the Missouri from hence by that route in 4 days." 4 days. It had taken the expedition 53 days to travel from the gates of the Rocky Mountains to its present location. Whatever emotions Lewis felt when he learned that the party might have saved 7 weeks, he kept to himself. The party camped the night of September 9th at the junction of a stream coming in from the west, today's Lolo Creek, some 10 miles south-southwest of Missoula. Old Toby informed Lewis that at this place the party would leave the Bitterroot River and head almost straight west up Lolo Creek and then over the mountains. The ordeal that every man had dreaded every time he looked left was about to begin. Lewis wrote of "those unknown formidable snow-clad mountains," which the party was about to attempt, "on the bare word of a savage, Old Toby, while 99/100th of his countrymen assured us that a passage was impracticable." "The weather appearing settled and fair," Lewis wrote, "I determined to halt the next day, rest our horses, and take some celestial observations." He called the campground Traveler's Rest. On the morning of September 10th, Lewis sent out all the hunters. They returned with 4 deer, a beaver, and 3 grouse. Even more welcome, if possible, Private John Coulter brought in three Indians from a tribe that lived across the mountains. The captains called them Flatheads, but they were almost surely Nez Perce. They were in pursuit of a band of Shoshones that had stolen 21 horses, proof that the mountains could be crossed. One of the three agreed to remain with the Americans to introduce us to his relations, whom he informed us were numerous and resided in the plain below the mountains on the Columbia River, from whence he said the water was good and capable of being navigated to the sea. He also told Lewis that some of his relation were at the sea last fall and saw an old white man who resided there by himself. The best news of all, Lewis recorded, was that the Indian said it would require 5 sleeps, which is 6 days' travel, to reach his relations. 6 days' travel wasn't so bad. Perhaps those mountains were not so formidable as they appeared. Further inquiry revealed that the river that flowed into the Bitterroot a few miles north, today's Clark Fork, received a smaller stream, today's Blackfoot, some little distance to the east, near the site of today's Missoula, and that it was this stream the Nez Perce followed to get to a low pass over the Continental Divide, bringing them to the Buffalo Country in the vicinity of either the Dearborn or the Medicine, today's Sun, River. That news confirmed that there were 2 mountain crossings required to get to the Missouri drainage from the Nez Perce country west of the Bitterroot Mountains, and it told the captains that there were at least 2 better routes across the Continental Divide than the one they had taken, one via today's Clark Fork to today's McDonald Pass, 6,320 feet, down to today's Helena, a second via the Blackfoot River to today's Lewis and Clark Pass, elevation 6,000 feet exactly, down to the Great Falls, and a possible third via Gibbons Pass, 6,941 feet, down the Wisdom River to the Jefferson River. Which of these answered Jefferson's order to find the most direct and practicable water communication across this continent? Only exploration would tell. It was much too late in the season to contemplate side journeys at this time. The entire party had to press on to the west, to the Pacific. Come next summer, on the return trip, they could examine the alternate routes. For now, the requirement was to get over the Bitterroots before the fall snows began. During the night of September 10th to 11th, 2 horses strayed. Not until 3 o'clock p.m. were they caught and brought in, so the expedition could get started up Lolo Creek on the Nez Perce Trail across the mountains, called today the Lolo Trail. It was an expensive delay. The Indian who had volunteered to guide the expedition to his people got impatient and took off. The party made 7 miles and camped. In the morning, Lewis found that his horse had strayed. He remained behind to search for it while Clark proceeded. On arrival at a hot springs that sprouted from the rocks and which was nearly boiling hot, today's Lolo Hot Springs, Clark waited for Lewis to come up. When he arrived, the party followed what Clark called a tolerable route that crossed the divide, separating the Bitterroot drainage from the waters flowing east. A couple of miles east of today's Lolo Pass, they came to a beautiful open glade, today's Packer Meadows. Continuing, the expedition fell down today's Pack Creek, Glade Creek to Lewis and Clark, and camped. Clark described the road west of the divide as very fine, level, open, and firm. Although the mountains stretched to the west as far as the eye could see, hopes were high. If the Indian informant was right, and if the road continued fine, in 4 days the expedition would be through the Bitterroots. But on September 14th, it rained, hailed, and snowed. Worse, old Toby got lost. The Nez Perce Trail followed the ridgeline, north of the river the captains called the Kooskooskee, today's Loxa, but old Toby led the party down the drainage to a fishing camp on the Kooskooskee. Indians had recently been there, and their ponies had eaten all the grass. Bad luck for the expedition. The road was much worse than yesterday, excessively bad and thickly strewed with falling timber, steep and stony. By the time the men made camp, near today's Powell Ranger Station, they and the horses were much fatigued and famished. Since the hunters had been unsuccessful, we were compelled to kill a colt to eat and named the South Fork Colt Killed Creek. On the 15th, the party followed the Kooskooskee downstream 4 miles, where old Toby recognized his mistake and led the men up today's Wendover Ridge on the north side of the river toward the ridgeline. The going was incredibly difficult. It was a steep ascent made worse by the immense quantity of falling timber. Several of the horses slipped and crashed down the hills. The horse carrying Clark's field desk rolled down the mountain for 40 yards until it lodged against a tree. The desk was smashed, but the horse was unhurt. When the party reached the ridgeline, at some 7,000 feet of elevation, there was no water. Using snow, the men made a soup out of the remains of the colt killed the previous day. The expedition had made only 12 miles, despite the greatest exertion. Even more discouraging, Clark wrote that, "From this mountain I could observe high, rugged mountains in every direction as far as I could see." There was no way the party was going to cross them in two more days. September 16th was the worst day the expedition had experienced to date. It began to snow 3 hours before dawn and continued all day, piling up to from 6 to 8 inches deep. Clark walked in front to find the trail and found great difficulty in keeping it because of the snow. The pine trees were covered with snow that fell on the men as they passed and brushed the limbs. Clark wrote in his journal, "I have been wet and as cold in every part as I ever was in my life." The party made but 13 miles, passing immense difficult knobs, stones, much falling timber, and immensely steep. The captains ordered a second colt killed, which we all supped heartily on and thought it fine meat. The horses, in a near-starvation situation, strayed during the night, searching for grass. It took the whole morning to find and bring them in. Not until 1 o'clock p.m. did the expedition set out. The road was excessively bad, and the party made only 10 miles. It camped at a sinkhole full of water. The hunters had managed to kill only a few grouse, insufficient for supper. "This compelled us to kill something. A colt being the most useless part of our stock, he fell a prey to our appetites." That was the last of the colts. The captains talked. The men's spirits were low. They were approaching the limits of physical endurance. The food supply was all but gone, and there was no hope of finding game. Lewis and Clark realized that the men, and they themselves, had reached a breaking point. But to retreat was unthinkable. They would rather die than quit, and in any case impractical, for the 5-day journey back to the Bitterroot River was probably beyond their capabilities. They had to go on. But to do so required desperate measures. The captains concluded that in the morning Clark would go ahead with 6 hunters. In Lewis's words, "to hurry on to the level country ahead and there hunt and provide some provision to send back to the main party, which would follow under Lewis's leadership." They hated to split up. In the past 17 months they had done so only during the Marias River exploration and in the search for the Shoshones, especially in these god-awful mountains, with no firm idea as to how far ahead the level country might be. On the morning of September 18th, Clark struck out at first light. That day, Lewis resumed writing in his journal. He had done so only twice in the past 3 weeks for unknown reasons. Evidently, he did so now to maintain a full record of the journey. He ordered the horses brought in early to force my march as much as the abilities of our horses would permit. Unfortunately, Private Alexander Willard allowed his horse to stray. Lewis sent him to search for it while the men ate what was left of the colt for breakfast. At 8:30 a.m., the party got started. Willard rejoined the men late that afternoon without his horse. Lewis made 18 miles that day and camped on the side of a steep mountain. He broke out a scant proportion of the portable soup, a few canisters of which, a little bear's oil and about 20 pounds of candles, form our stock of provision. The situation was critical, Lewis wrote, the only recourses being our guns and pack horses. Killing the pack horses would mean abandoning most of the baggage they were carrying, unthinkable with the Pacific still so far away, not to mention the return trip, and the rifles were but a poor dependence in a country where there is nothing upon earth except ourselves and a few small pheasants, grouse, small gray squirrels, and a bluebird of the vulture kind, either the pinion jay or Steller's jay. There was nothing for it but to proceed. In the morning, Lewis got the party going shortly after sunrise. At 6 miles, the ridge terminated at today's Sherman Peak, and we, to our inexpressible joy, discovered a large tract of prairie country lying to the southwest and widening as it appeared to extend to the west. There was an end to the mountains after all. The plain appeared to be 60 miles distant, but old Toby assured Lewis that we should reach its borders tomorrow. The appearance of this country, our only hope for subsistence, greatly revived the spirits of the party already reduced and much weakened for the want of food. Lewis pressed on. The road was excessively dangerous, being a narrow, rocky path generally on the side of steep precipice, from which in many places, if either man or horse were precipitated, they would inevitably be dashed in pieces. Late that afternoon, one horse did fall, and rolled with his load near 100 yards into the creek. We all expected that the horse was killed, but to our astonishment, when the load was taken off him, he arose to his feet and appeared to be but little injured. Lewis commented that this was the most wonderful escape I ever witnessed. The expedition's luck was changing. Only just in time. In addition to all the other problems, several of the men were sick with dysentery, and nearly all of them suffered from breakings out or eruptions of the skin, probably caused by venereal disease contracted from the Shoshone women. The following day, after proceeding 2 miles, Lewis saw a most welcome sight. The greater part of a horse which Captain Clark had met with and killed for us. Clark had also left a note saying he intended to proceed as fast as possible to the plains, where he intended to hunt until Lewis came up. The party made a hearty meal on our horse beef, much to the comfort of our hungry stomachs. But as Lewis ate, he got more bad news. One of the pack horses, with his load, was missing. That load was particularly valuable to Lewis, for it contained his stock of winter clothing. He sent Private Lepage, who was responsible for the horse, back to search for it, but Lepage returned at 3 o'clock p.m. without it. Lewis then sent 2 of my best woodsmen in search of him, and proceeded. The road was bad, as usual, with much deadfall. That night, the party finished the horse Clark had provided. It wasn't much. But sitting around the campfire, cold, hungry, exhausted, and miserable, Lewis summoned the energy to make significant additions to scientific knowledge, if he could get his journals back to civilization. He described the varied thrush, Steller's jay, the gray jay, the black woodpecker, known today as Lewis's woodpecker, the blue grouse, the spruce grouse, and the Oregon ruffed grouse, as well as the mountain huckleberry, the Sitka alder, and the western red cedar, called arbor vitae by Lewis. All but the thrush were unknown to science. On September 21st, Lewis didn't get started until 11 o'clock a.m. because he had to wait for the horses to be collected and his own pack horse to be brought in. He traveled down the heavily timbered bottom of a creek where the deadfall was so bad that it was almost impracticable to proceed. At 5 miles, he came to Clark's campsite on what Clark had named Hungry Creek, as at that place we had nothing to eat. After 6 more miles, Lewis came to a small open bottom where there was tolerable food for our horses and camped. I directed the horses to be hubbled to prevent delay in the morning, he wrote. He was determined to make a forced march tomorrow in order to reach, if possible, the open country. The hunters killed a few grouse. Lewis killed a prairie wolf, coyote, which, with the leftover horse meat and some crayfish, provided one more hearty meal, not knowing where the next was to be found. I find myself growing weak for the want of food, and most of the men complain of a similar deficiency and have fallen off very much. In the morning, to Lewis's chagrin, one of the men had neglected to comply with the order to hobble his horse. He pled ignorance of the order. Not until 11:30 a.m. did the party get started. It had proceeded some 2.5 miles when it met Private Reuben Field, a member of Clark's party, whom Clark had sent to meet Lewis with some dried fish and roots obtained from the Nez Perce. Field said that there was an Indian village some 7 miles farther west, that Clark had made a friendly contact with the Nez Perce and had been able to procure food from them. This was great news, as welcome as the fish and roots, which were sufficient to satisfy completely all our appetites. After eating, the party proceeded to a village of 18 lodges, which it reached at 5 o'clock p.m. The expedition had made 160 miles since it left Traveler's Rest 11 days ago. It was one of the great forced marches in American history. Lewis tried to describe his emotions. "The pleasure I now felt in having triumphed over the Rocky Mountains and descending once more to a level and fertile country where there was every rational hope of finding a comfortable subsistence for myself and party can be more readily conceived than expressed, nor was the flattering prospect of the final success of the expedition less pleasing. Outstanding leadership made possible the triumph over the Rocky Mountains. Lewis and Clark had welded the core of discovery into a tough, superbly disciplined family. They had built an unquestioning trust in themselves and knew the strengths and skills of each of their men intimately. They had taken a calculated risk in trusting old Toby, but their judgment that he knew what he was talking about, even though the talking was in sign language, proved to be justified. In extremely trying conditions, we suffered everything cold, hunger, and fatigue could impart, Lewis later wrote, as well as the keenest anxiety excited for the fate of our expedition in which our whole souls were embarked. The captains managed to keep morale from collapsing. The men never sulked, lashed out, demanded to retreat, or insisted on some alternative route. When the captains decided to take the great risk of separating, with Clark going on ahead, no man protested. Private Field told Lewis that Clark was at a second village, gathering information from the Nez Perce. At dark, Clark returned and joined Lewis. "I found Captain Lewis and the party encamped," he wrote, "much fatigued and hungry, much rejoiced to find something to eat of which they appeared to partake plentifully." Clark's experience was that too many roots had made his hunters violently ill, "so I cautioned them of the consequences of eating too much, etc." Clark was accompanied by Twisted Hair, a Nez Perce chief in his mid-60s whom Clark described as a cheerful man with apparent sincerity. Clark was the first white man most of the Nez Perce had ever seen. He informed Lewis that there were two villages in the area, called by the captains the Quamash Flats or the Camas Flats, today's Weipe Prairie near Weipe, Idaho, where the Indian women gathered great quantities of camas roots which they made into a kind of bread or cake. He said that at his request, Twisted Hair had drawn him a map on a white elk skin of the country to the west. Twisted Hair showed the creek they were on emptying into the Clearwater River, which was soon joined by a river coming in from the northeast, the North Fork of the Clearwater, and then flowing west to join with the Columbia. It was a 5-sleep journey to the Columbia, then another 5 sleeps to the falls of the Columbia. "At the falls," Clark said, "Twisted Hair places establishments of white people, etc., and informs that great numbers of Indians reside on all those forks, as well as the main river." If Twisted Hair was right, the expedition was within 10 days of the falls and a couple of weeks from the ocean. But the captains had learned that either Indian estimates of distances were too optimistic, or the Indians traveled a lot faster than the white men. And that business about white people living at the falls sounded suspicious. Anyway, the expedition wasn't going anywhere until it found trees big enough to make canoes. Over the next couple of days, the captains handed out medals to Twisted Hair and 3 lesser chiefs, along with shirts, knives, handkerchiefs, and tobacco. These trifles, except for the knives, did not satisfy. At the end of the second day, the Nez Perce indicated they were no longer going to feed the expedition for free. The captains traded from their diminishing supply of goods for more roots, berries, and dried fish. Clark's warning about overeating was easier given than followed. Lewis and his men gorged themselves and got sick, Lewis especially so. Most of the party were violently ill for a week, their dysentery producing acute diarrhea and vomiting. "All complain of a lax and heaviness at the stomach," Clark wrote, "so I gave Rush's pills." That was probably the worst thing he could have done. In any case, the following day, September 24th, Lewis was so sick he was scarcely able to ride on a gentle horse, several men so unwell that they were compelled to lie on the side of the road for some time. Clark was nothing if not persistent. He handed out more of Rush's pills. The sickness was presumably the result of the change of diet from all meat to all roots and dried fish. Bacteria on the salmon may have contributed. On the 25th, Lewis was still suffering from severe gastrointestinal distress. Clark tried giving him some salts and tartar emetic, another laxative, which hurt more than helped. The next day, Clark tried salts, pills, jalap, another purgative, tartar emetic, etc., again with unhappy results. By the 27th, most of the men were still sick, including Lewis. On the 28th, Clark opened his journal entry, "Our men nearly all complaining of their bowels, a heaviness at the stomach, and lax." Not until the 30th could Clark report, "The men recruiting a little." But they were still on a fish and roots diet, which the men complain of as working them as much as a dose of salts. In short, for over a week, the expedition resembled a hospital ward for the critically ill more than it did a platoon of fighting men. Herein lies one of the great stories of American history, even though it is a tale of what didn't happen rather than what did. It would have been the work of a few moments only for the Nez Perce to kill the white men and take for themselves all the expedition's goods. Had the Indians done so, they would have come into possession of by far the biggest arsenal not just west of the Rocky Mountains, but west of the Mississippi River, along with priceless kettles, axes, hatchets, beads, and other trade items in quantities greater than any of them would ever see in their lifetimes. Like the Shoshones, the Nez Perce had had no contact with whites, other than some cheap trade goods that had reached them from Columbia River tribes. They had only one or two inferior rifles. They were constantly harassed by their neighbors who did have guns, especially by the Blackfeet, when the Nez Perce made their annual trip over the mountains to the buffalo country. The Nez Perce were hardly oblivious to their once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. According to their oral history tradition, when they first met Clark and his six hunters, who had also gorged themselves on roots and fish and gotten dysentery, they considered killing them for their weapons. They were dissuaded by a woman named Watkuwius, meaning return from a far country. She had been captured by Blackfeet some 6 or 7 years earlier, taken into Canada, and sold to a white trader. She lived with him, among other traders, for several years before somehow finding her way home. The traders had treated her much better than the Blackfeet had done, so when Clark arrived, she told the warriors, "These are the people who helped me. Do them no hurt." First Sacagawea, now Watkuwius. The expedition owed more to Indian women than either captain ever acknowledged, and the United States owed more to the Nez Perce for their restraint than it ever acknowledged. When, in 1877, the Army, carrying out government policy, drove Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce from their Idaho home, there were in the band old men and women who had as children been in Twisted Hair's village. During the week Lewis was on his back, Clark moved camp to the junction of the North Fork of the Clearwater with the main stream, where there were ponderosa pines of sufficient size to make canoes. With only a few healthy men and inadequate axes, Clark resorted to the Indian method of canoe making. Instead of hewing out the trunks, he put them over a slow-burning fire trench and burned them out. Apparently, Twisted Hair showed him how to do it. It took 10 days to complete 4 large and 1 small canoe. Twisted Hair also promised to look after the expedition's herd of 38 horses until the Americans came back in the spring on their return journey. Clark had the horses branded with Lewis's branding iron, and to accompany the party to serve as an intermediary with Indians downstream. The captains had assumed that when they got out of the mountains, they would be in a country with an ample supply of deer and elk. They were wrong. The hunters, though still on their feet, were unsuccessful. Fish and roots purchased from the Nez Perce remained the diet. On October 4th, Lewis was still sick. The next day, Clark reported, "Captain Lewis and myself ate a supper of roots boiled, which filled us so full of wind that we were scarcely able to breathe. All night felt the effects of it." On October 6th, the canoes were finished. Clark made a cache for the saddles and a canister of powder. "I am very sick all night," he recorded. "Pain in stomach and the bowels." The next day he opened his journal entry, I continue very unwell, but obliged to attend everything. Evidently, Lewis was still so sick he couldn't even supervise the men's work. Lewis later wrote, "For my own part, I suffered a severe indisposition for 10 or 12 days, sick, feeble, and emaciated." Clark had the canoes put into the water and loaded. At 3 o'clock p.m., the party set out. The river was swift with many bad rapids. Nevertheless, they made 20 miles. The expedition was once again waterborne, going downstream for the first time since Lewis had turned the keelboat from the Ohio into the Mississippi River 2 years earlier. Ahead lay the Pacific. Chapter 24. Down the Columbia. October 8th to December 7th, 1805. As the expedition sped down the clear water toward its junction with the Snake, Lewis recuperated from his two-week bout with dysentery. On October 9th, Clark recorded, "Captain Lewis recovering fast." Soon he was as active as always. On October 13th, the party came to a very bad place, a long, bad rapid in which the water is confined in a channel of about 20 yards between rugged rocks for the distance of a mile. It cried out for portaging, but the captains and the men wanted to get on. They were on the last leg and finally had gravity working for them. So, Clark recorded, "Captain Lewis, with two canoes, set out and passed down the rapid. The others soon followed, and we passed over this bad rapid safe." The dugout canoes were cumbersome. They overturned or grounded on rocks. They swamped. They sprung leaks. Supplies were damaged, trade goods lost. Men's lives were endangered. The captains ran the rapids anyway, as many as 15 in a day. Old Toby was so frightened by the running of the rapids that he took off that night, without waiting for his pay. He was last seen running eastward along the riverbank. The captains asked Twisted Hair to send a horseman after Old Toby to ask him to come back to be paid, but Twisted Hair advised against such a course. The Nez Perce, he pointed out, would only take it from him as he passed their camps. Old Toby did pick up two of the expedition's horses to ride back over the Lolo Trail and then to Kamiawait's village on the Lemhi. On October 10th, the expedition reached the Snake River, coming in from the left, south. The party camped that night near the site of present Lewiston, Idaho. The men bought dogs and dried fish from local Indians. "All the party have greatly the advantage of me," Clark reported, "inasmuch as they all relish the flesh of the dogs." On the 14th, the unhappy Clark shot some ducks and was able to record, "For the first time for 3 weeks past, I had a good dinner of blue-winged teal." The expedition swept on toward the junction of the Snake and the Columbia, passing through the canyon-lined Snake on into present Washington State, where the great Columbian Plain offered a barren landscape in stark contrast to the wooded mountains the party was leaving behind. Along the way, the expedition passed innumerable Indian villages. The natives were members of the extended Nez Perce Nation, by far the largest and most powerful of the tribes of the Pacific Northwest. They had more horses than any tribe on the continent and were the only North American Indians to practice selective breeding. They scorned eating horse flesh. Their diet was primarily deer and elk, supplemented by large quantities of fish. The Columbia and Snake River system, on which they lived, produced more salmon than any other river in the world. Their catches were incredible. One man could kill 100 salmon on a good day, a full ton or more of fish. The Indians were hospitable, partly because Twisted Hair and another Nez Perce chief named Tito Harsky went ahead of the party to reassure their relatives that the white men were friendly, partly because, in Clark's words, "The wife of Charbonneau, our interpreter, we find reconciles all the Indians as to our friendly intentions. A woman with a party of men is a token of peace." Lewis was torn between his desire to keep moving and the need to bring the Nez Perce into the American orbit. He was not in American territory. Neither the United States nor Great Britain had established sovereignty over the Pacific Northwest. Both countries wanted it and had some sort of claim, as did the Russians and the Spanish. But Lewis and Clark were the first white men to enter present Idaho, Washington, and Oregon by land. Although they never planted a flag to make a formal claim on the territory for the United States, they acted as if it were already theirs. Lewis took a vocabulary of the different bands as they were encountered. He found variations in words, but correctly concluded that they had a common origin. Twisted Hair could understand them. The Yakimaws, Wanapoms, Walla Wallas, and others all belong to the same Shahaptian language family. They practiced a similar economy. They were all rich in dogs as well as horses. Not wanting to waste time sending out hunters, the captains continued to purchase dogs to have some meat to supplement their fish and roots. To bring the various branches of the Nez Perce into active participation in the American trading system, Lewis practiced his usual Indian diplomacy. Around the campfires on the banks of the rivers, he gave his speech expressing his joy in seeing those of our children around us, and handed out medals with Jefferson's likeness on them. He urged the Indians to make peace with their neighbors and promised them trade goods, and he began to form in his mind a grand scheme involving the Nez Perce that would cut the British out of the fur trade with the Orient. But long-term plans for an American takeover could be arranged in the spring, when the expedition could take its time going back upstream, since there was no point arriving on the western base of the Bitterroots before the snow had melted sufficiently to make a crossing practicable. That figured to be June at best, mid-July at worst. So when Chief Yelept of the Walla Walla Band asked Lewis to stay longer so that his people might come to see the white men, the captain excused himself. He wanted to keep moving. He promised instead that the party would spend a few days with Yelep's people in the spring. No matter how badly Lewis and Clark wanted good relations with the natives, sometimes they put daily needs first. "We have made it a point at all times not to take anything belonging to the Indians, even their wood," Clark noted on October 14th, "but since there was no timber on the island where the party camped that night, we are compelled to violate that rule and take a part of the split timber we find here. The next night, we were obliged for the first time to take the property of the Indians without the consent or approbation of the owner. The night was cold and we made use of a part of those boards and split logs for firewood." Stealing from the natives was as easy as it was tempting. The captains hated having it done to them, which was beginning to happen with increasing frequency as they made their way west. The articles taken were small, but because the trade goods were the captain's capital and diminishing fast, their anger was large. Still, their spirits were soaring. At night, around the fire, Private Crouzat brought out his violin, to the delight of the men, who danced to the music, and to the Indian guests, who watched and then did their own dancing. On October 15th, Lewis took a walk on the plains about the river and saw in the distance a mountain range that could only be the Cascades. The next day, the party reached the junction with the Columbia, the first white men to be on the river east of the Cascades. They camped for 2 days. Clark investigated the Columbia for about 10 miles upstream. The men were astonished at the numbers of salmon in the river, mostly dying after the spawn and therefore inedible. The water was so clear that no matter how deep the river, the bottom was plainly visible. By now, signs that the Pacific could not be far distant were everywhere. The nearness of the trading emporium at the mouth of the Columbia was apparent from items possessed by the natives, including scarlet and blue cloth blankets and a sailor's jacket. On October 19th, Clark climbed a cliff and saw a snow-covered mountain, which he deduced must be one of the mountains laid down by Vancouver, as seen from the mouth of the Columbia River. He thought it was Mount St. Helens. Actually, it was Mount Adams. But his essential point was right. Lewis's and Clark's sightings of the Cascades made the first connection, the first transcontinental linking, of what would become the United States. Lewis had long realized that the Columbia had to have many rapids and some major falls on it as it descended from the Rockies to the Pacific. On October 23rd, the expedition came to the beginning of a spectacular but dangerous stretch of the river that extended some 55 miles. It contained 4 major barriers, all inundated today by dam reservoirs, beginning with the Celillo, or Great Falls. In one short stretch of violent, roaring cataracts, the river dropped 38 feet through several narrow channels between cliffs as high as 3,000 feet. Today's Deschutes River came into the Columbia from the left just above the falls. At the mouth of the Deschutes, Lewis and Clark went off in different directions to examine the surrounding countryside and study the falls. Clark got to the falls first, Lewis having delayed on his exploration to examine a root, the wapato, that the natives dug in great quantities in the bottom of the Deschutes. After studying the falls and conferring, the captains decided that only the 20-foot drop had to be portaged. They were able to hire local Indians and their horses to help portage the heavier articles. At other places, they managed to lower the canoes through the rapids using strong ropes of elk skin while packing the baggage on a portage. Indians gathered on the riverbanks to watch the white men. Their presence was often a blessing. They had dogs and dried fish to sell, they provided information on the state of the river downstream, and they had a technology that the captains could use. Lewis visited a village where he had observed his first Chinookan canoe, made of pine, remarkably light, wide in the middle and tapering at each end, with crosspieces at the gunwales that made the craft surprisingly strong, and skillfully carved animal figures on the bow. Clark wrote that, "These canoes are neater made than any I have ever seen and calculated to ride the waves and carry immense burdens." Lewis was able to exchange the expedition's smallest canoe for one of the Indian craft, after he agreed to throw in a hatchet and a few trinkets. As the expedition prepared to make its way through the falls downstream, the captains learned that they would be passing into the country of a people with a different culture and language from any they had previously encountered. They were Chinookan, and the Nez Perce were at war with the Chinooks. On the night of October 23rd, Twisted Hair said he had heard from his relatives among the local Indians that the Chinookan people living farther down the river intended to kill the Americans when they arrived. The captains examined the rifles and made certain every man had 100 rounds of ammunition, but that was a daily routine anyway. Clark commented, "As we are at all times and places on our guard, we are under no greater apprehension than is common." The following day, Twisted Hair and Tito Harsky said they had decided to return home. They explained that the Chinooks would surely kill them if they had a chance. Besides, they could not speak the language, so they could no longer serve as interpreters. The captains persuaded the chiefs to stay with them for 2 months.